Discworld! It's Discworld! Podcast! Analysis! Yeah! Woo!
So I'm Josh, and I am your Unseen Academical for today, and I am finally here to talk to you about the fifth and final novel in the Discworld Death Sequence, and the 26th overall novel in the series, Thief of Time, from 2001, wherein Death's half-immortal granddaughter Susan Stohelet teams up with a young history monk on a journey of self-discovery to once again stop the auditors from constructing a perfect glass clock that would put an end to time itself, which prompts Death to round up all the other horsemen of the apocalypse in anticipation of finally riding out. This will be the first of two episodes on Thief of Time. In the second one, I am going to be looking at some ideas about time and things, as well as some literary allusions and comparisons that I think can be made to Thief of Time. But for this first episode, I am going to be focusing more on the characters in the novel. Sort of each section is divided up into a different character. Going to be looking at Susan's final arc, as well as some statistical analysis of her presence across the death sequence. Then I'm going to be delving into other characters, including Lady Lejeune, Lutze, Ronnie Soak, and Lobsang Ludd, and looking at how or whether or not they shape their own identities and individualities through the power of naming. Flying solo again, was hoping to have Eden back on for this one, because I know he said Thief of Time is one of his favorite Discworld books. But yeah, he was busy with work and stuff when I was first planning on recording this, and his schedule might have freed up now, but if I took time to organize and wait for that to happen, that would push this back even further. So I am trudging along by myself, as I've been a bit of an unheard academical as well of late, you know, taking some time off at the start of the year to finally finish my book manuscript, which has been completed and submitted. I'll probably have to do some more edits when I get the reviews back, but essentially it's done. That has been 6 years of my life, resulting in, I think I did the maths on it, and it was, I think, 217,000 words, which was about, I think it was 250 or so A4 pages. So quite an undertaking there. But that is out of the way, freeing me up to focus more on the podcast. But then, of course, I went and got COVID, which is still a thing, and which hit me pretty hard, I have to say. And I think I'm still coming down from it, no longer contagious or sick or anything, but I'm still a bit sniffly, which is somewhat ironic, or maybe the opposite, maybe suitable, in that this weekend I am also finishing up an article I'm writing about pandemic science fiction. So I'm experiencing that one firsthand. I'm also moving house next week because they decided to demolish mine, because why not? So yeah, lots of stuff going on, but hopefully, and I say this about everything, but hopefully once I'm moved and settled into the new house and I don't have any of these deadlines on my plate, I will be able to go back to producing a podcast more than once every 3 or 4 months, though it's kind of suitable that the last proper episode on Hogfather went out at Christmas, and this one will now be going out at Easter. So nice bit of a symmetry there, even if not necessarily ideal. This is going to be the first of two episodes on Thief of Time. No promises or speculations about when that might be. I do have the broad outline and the research done for it, but I do have to go through and sort of pull it all together, and then I have to record it, I have to edit it. So who knows? I'm done making speculations about when these episodes will come out, other than that they'll be done when they're done. But that second episode will be looking at some of the literary influences and parallels with the book, as well as delving into the idea of time, the physics and cultural history of time and associated literature, whereas this first episode will look broadly at some of the metaphysical ideas and characterizations present in Thief of Time itself, which I have been looking forward to, because I've said on a couple episodes now, I think this is my favorite Discworld novel. It's between this and Small Gods, and I've come to the conclusion that I do think Small Gods is the superior book, just in terms of looking at it as a piece of work, and I do love it. Like, these are both being my favorite Discworld books, some of my favorite books, period. But yeah, well, I think Small Gods is perhaps a superior work, the line I've come down to is Small Gods is the best Discworld novel, but Thief of Time is my favorite. It's a bit messier, perhaps not quite as profound, but has a lot of stuff going for it that I really enjoy. And I was glad to see that I've read it a couple of times now in preparation for putting this together and recording it, and to see that it really did hold up. Like I'd already read it when I started putting the outline for these episodes together. But then, yeah, there was one night where I couldn't sleep. I was up like 2-3 in the morning, just couldn't get to sleep. Wasn't feeling up to doing anything else, but it was clear I wasn't going to go to sleep. So I threw on the audio book of Thief of Time, and I ended up listening to the entire thing in one sitting, which, you know, I had it on double speed, so it was only like 4 hours or so. I didn't sleep that night, but I was just transfixed the entire time, engrossed. So I think it really holds up, and I've been excited to talk about it. But I guess this episode has also been delayed somewhat on top of everything else that I've got going on by the fact that I feel a bit intimidated talking about this one. You know, while it might not be quite as profound as Small Gods, still touching on a lot of big metaphysical ideas, even more so than I think any of the previous Discworld books. Maybe not Rupaman, but I think I find this one a bit more coherent, a bit more relatable. There's also a few areas in it that I don't really have extensive knowledge or insight into. So, you know, I want to do it justice, and the breadth and depth of material in this book is quite intimidating. So I think I've been putting it off a bit because of that as well. But let's not delay any longer. Let's get into it. And we start, as always, in honor of the RuPaul's Drag Race recap podcast, by naming two things I liked about the book and one thing I did not. And I'm going to start with the first thing I like about it. Despite everything I've just said about my trepidatiousness in going into this, I really do love and admire the thematic richness and breadth of this book. Its story is quite focused, but it is also branching out into different realms and areas of the Discworld. I mean, Lobsang and Lutse essentially travel from one end of it to the other, but also just thematically engaging with some of these metaphysical ideas and things like that, which we've dabbled in before in the previous Death books. But I think Pratchett is both most insightful and also the most coherent. He has been addressing these books, addressing these ideas within the death sequence here in Thief of Time. We were talking about in the Reaper Man episodes how, and the Soul Music ones as well, about how the ideas are sort of hitting on, or the different plot threads are sort of hitting on similar ideas and themes, but it doesn't always line up with the story, or, you know, it's sort of trading off, in Reaper Man's case, thematic depth for narrative coherence. And I think here in Thief of Time, I mean, he was pretty close with Hogfather, except for the wizard side plot with the shower. I'm still not sure how that fits into everything. And I think here, maybe because we don't get a slapstick wizard side plot, that the book, that the story and the themes align. Everything links into everything else. It all connects up. It's all feeding and reinforcing the different ideas and the different plot threads. Even when it's not obvious, I think there is a thematic and narrative consistency that runs through this book, and I'm just really quite impressed by it. I think this is definitely one of Pratchett's better written and certainly better plotted books, on top of just the content itself being interesting and engaging. So that's the first thing I liked, which is to say kind of all of it. More specifically, the second thing I liked, and again, I like pretty much everything about this book, but the thing I think specifically that I like the most, if I have to isolate one part of it as my favorite, I do think, despite the major focus being on Lobsang and Susan as the two protagonists, the scenes that I find most interesting and that I remember the most vividly are the Jeremy sections. I really like his character and just the idea about, you know, making the clock. And then also, I think this is maybe the best Igor we get in the Discworld series. I mean, essentially, this is so my thing. Like, it's a setup of the gothic mad scientist, you know, Frankenstein sort of situation. So that directly appeals to me. I think we get a bit more of that in Making Money, in the scenes there with the calculating machine or whatever it's called, that I really like as well. So this is just hitting on imagery and ideas that I like, but I think it's really well done here. And you also get the interactions between Jeremy and Lady Lejeune. So there's a lot of good character work and thematic work going on there. As for the one thing I did not like about the book, like, I don't think this book is perfect. As I said, I don't think it quite stands up to Small Gods in terms of just its raw composition. But a lot of the things I don't like are pretty minor, pretty nitpicky. I guess the biggest misstep in Thief of Time is Lady Lejeune's suicide at the end, which we'll talk about a bit more, I think, in part two. But I think that is the one part of the book that it does fit in with everything, but I don't know if it was the best choice for the character and the themes, even if it does sort of fit in with the plot and some of the ideas Pratchett is exploring in Thief of Time and the broader Death series. But on a personal note, though, I don't love the emphasis on chocolate in this book, which is because I don't like chocolate, and I never have. This has been a thing my entire life. My dad didn't like chocolate either, but literally everybody else I've ever met in my entire life loves chocolate. And people take it personally when you tell them you don't like chocolate. That is until they realize that the benefit of being friends with you is when you get given chocolate and they get double the chocolate. But yeah, I've had people I've known pretty much my whole life still give me chocolate. And I have to say, oh, thank you, but no, I don't like it. And then they go, oh, yeah. It's like they blank it out of their mind, sort of in a very Pratchettian, you know, the mind blocking out what it doesn't want to see sort of thing, like Susan in the Gentleman's Club. When I tell people I don't like chocolate, they sort of erase it from their memory because it can't possibly fit in with their reality. I like chocolate milk and certain chocolate flavored things. I like my favorite beers that I like dark beers, and I normally like sort of the chocolatey flavored ones. So I like chocolate milk, chocolate beer. I like white chocolate, which is a completely different taste, but that is, I'm recording this over Easter, and I've gone and bought myself a block of the Milky Way with the cookie bits in it, which I guess they're chocolate flavored as well. So I can tolerate sort of here and there, but just pure chocolate, like I have a physical reaction to it. I have a particularly vivid sense memory from my childhood of the smell of just a plain Dairy Milk Freddo Frog that just made me gag. And like I can call up that taste and the smell. Like if someone opens that, or even just a block of chocolate around me and the smell hits me, it makes me nauseous. It makes me want to gag. So in some ways, I guess I'm sympathetic to the auditors and the weaponization of chocolate against them. But perhaps going in the opposite direction, I'm getting a sensory overload from it, but not a pleasurable one. So yeah, I can't really relate to the idea of chocolate as the ultimate in taste sensation. It does seem like a little bit of an obvious, cheap sort of gag, the death by chocolate thing, especially given its relationship or that's being tied into the female characters in particular. It just seems a little bit on the nose for a book that I think goes a lot deeper and goes beyond some of these base instincts that are perhaps more prominent in Pratchett's other works. But yes, if that's the thing I don't like about the book, I think that only goes to show how good it really is. But that's what I think of it. So let's turn now to some of the reviews. So I'll begin, as always, by checking in with Andrew M. Butler and his Pocket Essential Guide to Terry Pratchett. And Thief of Time is actually the most recent Discworld book that he reviews in the Pocket Essential Guide. It was the most recent one that had been released or that Butler had access to, because the Pocket Guide also comes out in 2001. And he gives it a 4 out of 5, which is the highest rating he's given any of the Death novels since Mort. He gave Mort a 5 out of 5, and then I think we went 3-2 and then 3 again for Hogfather, I think. So according to Butler, the Death series begins and ends rather strongly, but dips in the middle. Again, I thoroughly disagree with that assessment. I definitely think the Death series is the most consistent of all of the Discworld sub-series, and where I have brought in criticisms about, you know, the lack of thematic cohesion in Reaper Man and things like that, I really am nitpicking. You know, taking Reaper Man as the subject, and then you're asked, hey, well, where does this fall a bit short? But again, any sort of assessment or rating I would give of a Pratchett book, or a Discworld book at least, compared to the other Discworld books, I'm sort of already assuming that they're a notch above non-Discworld books, right? So for me, Reaper Man only really falls short in comparison to the other Discworld books, and specifically those of the Death series. And I definitely think that Thief of Time is a better book than Mort. I mean, I think, in fact, on this reread, I do think Mort is the weakest of the Death series, just because it's the most simplistic. It's certainly the most important and significant entry for Discworld and broader popular culture as well. But in terms of just the literary value of the books themselves, I think it's hard to look at something like Thief of Time or Hogfather and would say that they are, you know, lesser literary works than Mort and the other early Discworld novels. But Butler still gives Thief of Time a 4 out of 5, saying that the use of time is very impressive, but the linkages of the various threads is a bit clumsy, although a case can be made for it being thematically right. So I think he's sort of looking at Thief of Time the same way that I sort of think of Reaper Man. He also notes that it's a rather unique entry in the Discworld series, pointing out that there are curiously few returning elements, beside Death, Susan, and the death of rats and Igor. As he notes, the wizards curiously set out the events, while the librarian and the watch are nowhere to be seen. And he says that even Nanny Ogg's appearance is quite different from usual. And I do agree with him there. I mean, it's just strange to see her outside of the context of Granny Weatherwax and the other witches, I guess. I think I mentioned in one of the previous episodes my fan fiction premise of Susan versus Granny Weatherwax. And like, we sort of get a showdown here between Susan and Nanny Ogg, who I think there's a way of looking at it. And I think I've seen some other people argue that, you know, maybe she is actually the most powerful witch because she can deal with and to some extent, not manipulate, but direct Granny Weatherwax. Though I think we see in Carpe Jugulum, Nanny is more or less ineffective without Granny Weatherwax and openly admits that she is far less powerful in terms of actual magic and things. But still, I was a little bit disappointed by the confrontation between Susan and Nanny Ogg. I mean, Nanny Ogg, for as significant a role as she plays as the midwife of time, she really is only there as someone to provide Susan with information to direct her towards Lobsang. Like, she doesn't do anything in the narrative itself. And rather than just having Susan show up and Nanny tell her what she needs to know, right, we get a bit of, a confrontation between the two. And I'm a little bit shocked at just how easily it seems Susan steamrolls Nanny. I mean, it's implied in the narrative that Nanny wants her to ask her the right questions so that she'll tell her what she needs to know. Like, she's not putting up too much resistance. But if we did want to have some kind of, I don't know, conflict or just a hurdle within Susan's story to make it a bit more eventful, I think maybe we could have seen Nanny putting up a bit more of a fight and then maybe still wanting to tell Susan what she wants to tell her, but not just instantly giving up, as it were. But yeah, I do think it's strange that given their involvement and their sort of dedicated side plots in the previous Death books, that, yeah, we don't get any interference or appearance from the wizards, with whom I'm including the librarian. I sort of get why the watch aren't involved, because everything is happening on a metaphysical plane, but it seems like the wizards should certainly be aware that there are time meddlings going on. I mean, the book is already fairly long and fairly stuffed, so I understand why they were cut out just from a narrative necessity point of view, but I do think that is a noticeable omission when looking at the books within the context of the Death books and the broader Discworld series, which, yeah, I agree with Butler, gives this one its own individual sort of tone. Like, this is more in line with the later Discworld books, wherein the wizards aren't really that involved, and also makes it a little bit more of its own standalone story. Like, it helps if you know who Nanny Ogg is, but yeah, you don't really need to know the politics and inner workings of the Watch and the wizards to follow just the story of what is going on with Lutze and Jeremy and the whole clock plot. But as Butler also points out, the clock plot itself, or at least its mechanics, are not as unique as that all suggests. So as Butler notes, Pratchett has played with time before, pointing out that in Weird Sisters, we have a whole period of time being removed to allow Tom John to grow up, that in Pyramids, we also have the past and present being brought into collision, and that we also go back in time and visit the primeval dawn in the Last Continent. But there we're looking at sort of magical manipulations of time and things, whereas I think in Thief of Time, we get a much more insightful look at the nature of time itself. So that's what Butler thought of the book. And, you know, I have stopped looking for secondary reviews because they're hard to track down and they are normally not that insightful, right? Butler's worth looking at because, as well as being, you know, sort of the prominent Pratchett scholar, we also have a continuum of reviews in the Pocket Guide that we can dip in and out of and see how they compare together. But Thief of Time is rather notable because English author A.S. Byatt, whose novel Possession won the Booker Prize in 1990, is widely credited with claiming that it should have done the same, which is to say, she said, Thief of Time should have won a Booker Prize. Indeed, Byatt wrote a highly favourable review of Thief of Time for our round world version of the Times newspaper, wherein she commended him for doing what postmodern knowing fiction that says we're all made up of patches and quotations of other forms and other stories does, but with the real energy of the primary storyteller. However, I cannot find a primary source for her saying that she thinks it's deserving of the Booker Prize. I can find a lot of secondary sources, including multiple interviews, wherein Pratchett acknowledges Byatt's Booker endorsement and appears to confirm it, including one I'm going to talk about a bit more later, and also a 2000 interview in the January magazine where, yeah, he says Thief of Time will never be nominated for the Booker Prize, and also claims that The Amazing Maurice won't win the Carnegie Medal and that his income and notoriety would suffer if it did. So perhaps not the most trustworthy assessment from Pratchett there. But yeah, I can't find a record of Byatt saying this. I'm not saying she didn't, just that it says everywhere that she said it, but it doesn't say anywhere what she said. And I have a bit of a conspiracy theory here that I think there may be some confusion in that Byatt's endorsement of Thief of Time is often quoted in the press material alongside Sunday Telegraph critic Charles Spencer's assessment that Thief of Time is the best Pratchett book that he's read to date, and he says, "I'm not being entirely frivolous when I suggest that it ought to be a strong contender for the Booker Prize." So yeah, this quote is often asserted alongside Byatt. Like, I think it's in the promotional material in my hard copy of the book, and I've seen them quoted next to each other in a few other places. So I do wonder if there's maybe a bit of a mix-up there, whether the two ideas are being conflated and Byatt's being credited with Spencer's Booker endorsement, or alternatively, since Pratchett and lots of other people seem to say that she did say this, that they both thought it was worthy of the Booker. But yeah, Spencer's is the only Booker endorsement that I can find a record of. All of this is moot, however, because of course Thief of Time wasn't nominated for the Booker Prize. I think in one of the interviews where Pratchett talks about Byatt's alleged endorsement, he says that he thinks his publisher did send it in for consideration, but it never made the shortlist. But I think it's interesting to look at some of the nominees and indeed the winners of the Booker Prize and other fantasy awards within the same time frame. So Thief of Time was not nominated for, nor did it win, the 2001 Booker Prize, which was instead won by Yann Martel's magical realist, which is to say fantasy novel, The Life of Pi. I am being a bit facetious there, obviously, but I think Life of Pi is a little bit more psychological in terms of its magical realism, but I do find often that genre tag gets thrown around to justify fantasy texts as, you know, legitimate literary novels. But yes, a fantasy-ish novel won the 2001 Booker Prize. And while it seems outside the, not the realm of possibility, but the realm of likelihood that Thief of Time would be nominated for that kind of award, there does seem to be a trend towards more fantastic and extrapolative fiction around the turn of the millennium. The previous year's shortlist included the science fiction and fantasy author David Mitchell's semi-cyberpunk novel Number 9 Dream, which coincidentally includes a character who resembles the Taoist founder Lao Tzu, as does Thief of Time. The year before that, the award was won by Margaret Atwood's Blind Assassin, which includes multiple nested science fiction fantasy narratives within it. And the following year, after The Life of Pi, the award was won by DBC Pierre's satirical black comedy novel of Verno Godlim. So as ludicrous as it might seem that, yeah, this parodic post-fiction fantasy novel might be nominated for the Booker Prize, there does seem to be some precedent around the time of its release that the award was taking both fantastic and comedic novels more seriously, but obviously not seriously enough to nominate Thief of Time itself, which interestingly was also not nominated for any of the major science fiction or fantasy awards. The relevant Hugo Award, which is to say the 2002 one because it's for the year before, went to Neil Gaiman's American Gods. The 2002 Nebula Award was won by Catherine Issaro for her book Quanta Rose, with American Gods winning the year after, so again, sort of publication deadlines and things. And Gaiman also won the Lucas Fantasy Award for Best Novel, so a clean sweep of all the major American science fiction and fantasy awards by Gaiman there with American Gods. And yeah, perhaps it's because of the, I guess, less comedic tone of his work. Yeah, American Gods is more or less, I think, the book that really established Gaiman as a true literary force, a proper and serious fantasy author, I guess. And before that, he was still highly regarded, but mostly for his comic works and his short stories and his collaboration with Pratchett on Good Omens, even though he had previously written Neverwhere, which I still think is his best book, and a much better book than American Gods, which I really don't think think is very good, not particularly deserving of all the claim and reverence it has within the fantasy and literary canon. But Gaiman has this reputation as a more serious and celebrated author, both within, I guess, the broader literature sphere and also just fantasy itself. I mean, looking at the Locus Awards, Gaiman has won 18 separate Locus Awards for his fiction, including further novel awards for Anansi Boys and Ocean at the End of the Lane, Young Adult Novel Awards for Coraline and the Graveyard Book, as well as 6 Novelette Awards, 5 consecutive Short Story Awards from 2003 to 2007, and then 3 more from 2010 to 2012, whereas it took until 2008 for Pratchett to win his first Lucas Fantasy Award for Making Money, which I think is a pretty deserving winner there. And he also won the YA Award for all 4 of his Tiffany Aiken novels, which I think is where his fiction seems to be taken more seriously. But yeah, Gaiman still has a more literary and adult reputation, and also still, you know, Coraline and the Graveyard Book are these celebrated children's books as well. Now, there's an American bias here, because these are all American awards, and I did complain, I think, in our first episode about how Pratchett hadn't won or been nominated for any of these awards for at least his early Discworld books. And this is to do with, or a factor of it is to do with marketing technicalities, like the cutoffs for when you can be nominated for these awards have to do with when the book gets published and where. Like, I'm not going to go into all that, but there is a section in, I think it's the Mark Burroughs biography, The Magic of Terry Pratchett, where it talks about how, yeah, it goes into more detail about his award eligibility. And I think either there or in the Wilkins Life with Footnotes biography, in one of those, I think it claims that Pratchett specifically swat publishers at one point with an eye towards being taken more seriously in the US and being eligible for these awards and things. At the same time, however, Thief of Time didn't win any major British fantasy awards either. It wasn't even nominated for the British Science Fiction Association Award for Best Novel, which Gaiman's American Gods also missed out on winning to Alistair Reynolds' Revelation space novel Chasm City. But again, Gaiman was nominated, Pratchett was not. But yeah, Pratchett only ever won the British Science Fiction Association Award once in 1989 for Pyramids of All Novels. Yes, also did not receive any other nominations for that award before or after that. Although interestingly, Gaiman has never won nor received any other British Science Fiction Association nominations, despite his prominence in America. And neither novel was nominated for the Arthur C. Clarke Award, which went to Gwyneth Jones's Boulder's Love, which listeners may remember from my worst books I read last year list that I put out. Thief of Time was nominated for the 2002 Wodehouse Prize, which was established in the year 2000 in honour of Pratchett's idol P.G. Wodehouse to honour the best comedic novel of the year, but Thief of Time unfortunately lost to Michael Frayn's Spies. Pratchett was nominated for the Wodehouse Award twice more for Going Postal and Thud, before finally winning in 2012 for Snuff, of all books. So yes, I guess in terms of the Wodehouse Award, books dealing with the metaphysics of time and existence and things are less funny than books where most of the humour derives from a child reading from the world of Pooh. And finally, just to round out, I guess, all the major fantasy awards, Thief of Time was not nominated for the World Fantasy Award, whereas again, Gaiman's American Gods was, but lost out to Ursula K. Le Guin's final Earthsea novel, The Other Wind, which I think is by far the weakest entry in that series, and then strikes me as a bit more of a legacy award there. But yes, also interestingly, Gaiman has never won that award, and Pratchett was only ever nominated for his collaboration with Gaiman on Good Omens. So yeah, despite his extreme popularity, I mean, this is coming in 2001, so we are in the post-Harry Potter paradigm, but still coming off the end of the 90s when Pratchett was at his peak. So yeah, despite his immense popularity and these endorsements from Booker Prize winning authors and things, even the best and most, I guess, philosophical of Pratchett's works were not being taken seriously by the science fiction and fantasy establishment, especially in America, but even in his home country of the UK. Yeah, so I guess, sorry if that became a bit rambly or ranty there, but, you know, just me listing off all these awards and things, but as much as they can sort of be disregarded, right, the idea that Pratchett won scarcely few of these major awards, despite his popularity and the quality of his works and just the figure that he is within fantasy and popular literature, you know, sort of says that the awards aren't really worthy or indicative of an author's literary or cultural quality. I do think they're interesting to look at because, you know, whether they're an accurate measure or the best measure, they are a measure of popular and critical trends and reception. And as with American Gods, like, they have a hand in making authors into more respected and celebrated figures. You know, for a while, I was keeping a pretty close eye on these sort of awards and nominations and things. I've dropped off over the last few years because I don't think many of the winners and nominees have been particularly deserving, whereas, you know, books that I've read in the years that I have really enjoyed haven't been nominated. I mean, I'm pretty shocked that Jeff Vandermeer is Born also wasn't nominated for any of these awards and things. So yeah, I think it's interesting to look at from a cultural historicist point of view. But that might be because, you know, I'm living it, I'm in the moment, and also it's a lot more easy to discover things, be exposed to different books in the age of the internet and wider publishing and things like that. When I do look at the list of early Hugo and Nebula winners, you know, there's some duds in there. But, you know, for the most part, the pre-90s stuff at least is pretty good in terms of recommending and recognizing these really good and significant works. But maybe at the same time, the only reason that they are so significant and well widely read is because they were recognized in this way. And Pratchett has missed out on this recognition, which may not have been important to him in his lifetime. Like, he was certainly successful enough without them. But I do wonder to what extent it will impact his longevity as a cultural figure as the Discworld becomes more of a historical rather than contemporary work. So I want to begin the analysis of Thief of Time, as I have done with the last two Death Sequence books, by looking broadly at Susan and her role in the story and the way people have responded to it. Maybe won't go into as much depth about Susan here as I have in the previous two books, because I think we've sort of hashed it out there, and perhaps she plays a less significant role in Thief of Time, as we'll get onto. But I did find some of the other critics' responses to Susan's role in Thief of Time to be quite interesting and perhaps contentious. So in her 2018 master's thesis on Pratchett, Gaiman and the Personification of Death, Akiki V. Cannon, we've cited a fair bit in these episodes, says that here we finally see Susan as a fully realized and fully at peace character. She's still not overjoyed when family duty calls, but she no longer fights who she is, having become less of a goth Mary Poppins and more of a stern Victorian era version of the magic school bus's Miss Fizzle, which I think is a pretty good assessment, that transition away from the sort of whimsical characterization of the governess in Hogfather towards something a little bit more cynical and self-assured here, where even though she was undercutting some of the institutionalized ideas at the school in Hogfather, she was an outlier. Whereas in this book, she seems like she's taking charge, and she's a bit more self-determined, and I guess just has a little bit more autonomy and direction over not just herself, but her situation and her career. And nevertheless, in a 2001 interview on the BBC Radio 4 program Open Book, Pratchett maintained Susan's likeness to Mary Poppins, which is sort of just, you know, his generic descriptor when he's talking to a broader audience who aren't perhaps as familiar with the books and the character. Of course, this is in 2001, so he's talking in promotion of the book. So if you say, hey, Susan, she's like Mary Poppins, gives you a broad idea. But there was a bit of pushback from the program's host, Philippa Gregory, who is herself a historical novelist. That is, a novelist of historical fiction, not a novelist from history, although I guess she is both, time and all that. But yeah, so she's a writer herself. And I found, from that interview at least, a rather hostile interviewer. I found she was often interrupting and talking over Pratchett, who she accused of attacking teachers in his portrayal of Susan and the other appalling teachers in Thief of Time, such as the headmistress, Madame Frau, who disapproves of competition. But she also called Susan a terrible type for guarding the stationery cupboard at all costs. So I don't know if Gregory has a history as a teacher herself or what was going on there, but she didn't seem too pleased with Pratchett's portrayal of teachers, or just Pratchett in general, really. And while Pratchett has always satirized formalized education, I mean, this is the Unseen University Wizards that begin the Discworld series are an indictment of university teachers and things, and he's certainly having a go at Madame Frau and this whole, you know, learning through fun idea that she stands in for. But I think it's pretty clear that Susan is the antidote to all the other powerful teachers, in Pratchett's mind at least. She is his ideal teacher, and she is perhaps rather stern, but I think it is also shown in her characterization in Thief of Time that she is quite sympathetic and, most importantly, understanding of her students, knows what they need, even if she's withholding the satisfaction from, I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but the kid in her class who's always trying to answer the questions and things that she knows to throw a bird every now and then. I thought his characterization of Susan was quite insightful from a teaching perspective. In other parallels, we have Canon also comparing Susan to the Greek goddess Persephone, who we've talked about quite a lot. Seems to be a recurring reference, perhaps the most recurring reference throughout a lot of Pratchett's work, primarily in the Witches and Tiffany Aching series. But Canon compares Susan to Persephone, saying that they are both women who cross between the human world and the domain of death, and who do not initially go willingly into the realm of death, nor do his bidding without complaint, arguing that much like Persephone's dual nature as a goddess of both spring and the underworld, Susan eventually becomes at home both as a character, both as a caretaker of children, and thus the new life we imagine coming with spring, and as a wielder of the powers of death. And while those parallels do exist, I think that's a bit of a stretch. You know, you've got to make quite a few jumps to get those parallels to align. You know, primarily the death one's obvious, but linking spring and Susan's profession as a teacher, I don't know if I'm buying it, and this comparison seems to me born out of an attempt to find a connection between Susan and Neil Gaiman's treatment of death in the Sandman series, but I did think was perhaps worth pointing out, given Pratchett's ongoing preoccupation with Persephone, who I think he reinterprets much more explicitly in Reaper Man, if we want to keep things in the death series, but also whose story is directly reinterpreted in other Discworld books like Lords and Ladies and Wintersmith. As to Susan's function in the story of In Thief of Time story itself, we have Tansy Rayner Roberts commenting in her 2018 Essays on Female Characters of the Discworld that despite seeming to have come into her own and matured as a character, Roberts notes that the pattern of Susan tidying up the B-plot and her thinly sketched romantic connections are repeated once again. And Gregory also dismisses Susan and Lobsang's relationship as a would-be love affair in the BBC Open Book interview. I think Nadav and I rejected the emphasis on Susan's relationship with the Ear God of Hangovers in Hogfather. Her relationship with Lobsang in Thief of Time is quite reminiscent of her implied crush on Imp in Soul Music. And even though it's, you know, pretty explicitly implied at the end of Thief of Time that Susan and Lobsang are destined lovers, that they are soulmates to some degree, she certainly interacts more and has more explicit and displayed feelings for Imp in Soul Music. So I guess this is another area of the book that, you know, it comes up a bit short. I think it is saved by the thematic connection in that Susan is looking for someone like herself, and maybe the book is better for it being an implied romance rather than having her dote on Lobsang throughout the narrative. But yeah, I do think maybe that itself would work better if the implication of their destined relationship at the end of the book, which was softened a little bit, that yes, they were going to go off and they were happy to have found each other, but it wasn't like this kind of star-crossed lovers meant to be sort of thing. I mean, it is the end of Susan's story, is that she finds a man who she doesn't really have a developed relationship with. As Roberts notes of the romance between Susan and Lobsang, they hardly ever cross paths throughout the book, and their meetings are handled exactly the same way as her interactions with Buddy and Bilious, with their few scenes together involving them getting snarky at each other upon early acquaintance and never quite managing to convey any mutual attraction. As we've seen going through these books, like Pratchett does fall into fairly similar archetypes or character archetypes. Like, it's not just Susan who has these snarky interactions with other characters. I mean, we get this with Tiffany and Esk and, you know, even Granny Weatherwax and Ridcully, perhaps even Eve Vimes and Lady Sybil. So it is sort of par for the course for Pratchett's characterization, but I do think it is a bit shallower in Susan's case, given the narrative emphasis that gets put on hers and Lobsang's relationship at the end of Thief of Time. And even if we're conceding it, then like her relationship with Bilious, even if it's not romantic, they have constant interactions throughout Hogfather. Whereas in Thief of Time, Susan shows up and meets Lobsang when she winds up his timer. But then she is with Lady Lejeune till the end of the book. And it's with her that Susan's relationship is more fully developed. It might have been interesting to see her going off with Lady Lejeune, either romantically or otherwise, at the end of the book. I think that would have been perhaps the one change I might want to make if I were to make one to Thief of Time, which again is one of my all-time favorite books of all time. But yeah, Susan's relationship with Lobsang is not really developed. It's sort of this implied companionship. At the same time, though, it's probably about as developed as Isabel and Mort's relationship was. There's another example of the sort of snarkiness that suddenly becomes, oh, but I love him. And I think a lot of other people would have been more satisfied with the Susan-Lobsang relationship had Pratchett revisited the characters and developed it further, right? It's not so much the meeting that is the problem. It's the, and they live happily ever after because they were meant to be a coda and culmination of Susan's story that I think makes it unsatisfying. And yet, despite Pratchett falling into these common patterns, we do have relationships like McGrath and Verence, Tiffany and then the pig farmer, Angua and Carrot, Vimes and Sybil, and so on, or even Vetinari and Lady Margalotta, that show that Pratchett can do this. Like, I think he is good at developing these deeper relationships, but over a longer series, over multiple books where it gets to develop, rather than in a single book where, you know, he's more focused on the plot and the jokes and the themes. He's not necessarily the best character writer. Like, he makes good characters, interesting characters, iconic characters, but any depth that comes with them is normally borne out over a couple of novels. Within the stories, they normally serve a certain function when they first appear. But yeah, we never got to see what happened with Lobsang and Susan, either together or apart after this. I don't know why Pratchett never revisited Susan, especially given that she's quite a popular character. We do know from the Life with Footnotes biography that Pratchett was planning one more Susan book before he died, wherein Susan would have become the headmistress of the Quirm College for Young Ladies, which, you know, follows the pattern of her career progression throughout the other death books. Apparently that book would have been called Upschool with an exclamation mark. I imagine that is some kind of British colloquialism that I don't get or understand. Upschool seems like a bit of a strange one. I kind of hope he would have found an alternate title for that had it come to fruition. Although Rainer writes that if there was ever another Susan book that she would fully expect that Lobsang would not be mentioned in it. Given Pratchett's treatment of Susan's previous love interests, which I think is a little bit unfair. There is a reason for Imp's absence from the later stories, and that his life and timeline is reset. You know, we find the bilious romance contentious to begin with, and he ends up going off with the Tooth Fairy, so it makes sense why they never brought up again. I think it would be pretty difficult to ignore Lobsang were Susan's story to be continued, although Pratchett more or less managed it with Mort and Isabel in Reaperman, even if their story was revisited and concluded in Soul Music. But yeah, that is where Susan stands at the end of the death sequence. One of Pratchett's most iconic and well-liked characters, if a rather underutilized and, dare I say, ultimately shallow one. I think the potential of Susan is what is so appealing. While we get glimpses of her throughout the three books she's in, she never quite becomes everything she could have been. And given that this is the last time we hear of her halfway through, or a bit over halfway through, what ended up being the complete series, it's a bit of a shame. But I still think she is one of Pratchett's most interesting and memorable creations. So in addition to her analysis of Susan's character, Roberts also claims that in Thief of Time, there's less focus on Death, who doesn't get much of a subplot to himself, allowing for more Susan Page time, but not a lot more, she says. At the same time, she claims that Susan is absent for large sections of the book and isn't given much to do, which seems a bit contradictory. And I too noticed a big gap in Susan's appearances when I was reading through the book. So I've gone and done a statistical analysis on Susan's appearances, not just in Thief of Time, but in all of the death books. And now these are based on the PDF copies that I have of the books. They're not based on the hard copy versions that I have. So when I'm talking about page numbers and things, this isn't going to line up with the actual physical published novels. So keep that in mind. I'm not going to go through and actually count all the Susan appearances and things, or find exact page references for when she appears and when she doesn't appear, which I might have to do if I was actually publishing an article about it, but I think even then I'd probably find my way to citing an ebook. But yeah, anyway, just keep in mind that when I'm reeling off these numbers, they probably won't line up with any physical books you have. But let's start at the beginning, shall we? So in Soul Music, which is of course Susan's first appearance, she appears in 110 out of 289 of the PDF pages, which is equal to about 38%, so just over a third, which seems fair given that that book is fairly evenly split between the three main stories of Susan and then Death and Buddy as well. Which, yeah, given some of the criticisms we looked at on the Soul Music episodes about the way, you know, Susan wasn't really playing a main role, that seems to suggest that she is playing an equal role in terms of appearances. Maybe, you know, at the same time she's overlapping with the other characters and she's playing more of a side role or a less active role, but in terms of just presence on the page, she seems very represented in Soul Music. And despite accusations that she just shows up at the end and fixes everything, her appearances actually decrease throughout the later third of Soul Music, with the longest gap between her appearances being 29 pages between pages 237 and 266 of the 289 PDF pages, which I'm not sure. Maybe that's the chase with Death and Things. I'm not sure. Again, I didn't go and line these up with the books themselves, but yeah, we've got about 30 pages towards the end where she doesn't show up. Before that, though, she's never absent from the narrative for more than 10 or so pages, 12 at the most. And moving on to Hogfather, which I said in those episodes, for me, is the Susan book where she seems like she is the most active and the most essential to the plot and things. And that does seem to be reflected in her statistical appearances, because in Hogfather, she appears in 174 of the 393 pages, which is just under half the book at 44%. Again, the longest gap between Susan's appearances is 31 pages, as opposed to 29 in Soul Music, so around the same gap there. This time, though, it happens early, between pages 32 and 63 of the PDF. There's a few other larger gaps of 15, 25, 30 pages throughout, but she otherwise appears fairly consistently. I am a little bit surprised that she still shows up in less than half the book of what I'm contending is her, like, major narrative. But again, the Hogfather story is split between Susan's plot, but also Death and Tea Time, and the wizard side plot also plays more of a role in that book than it does in Soul Music as well. So I think, you know, if I delved a bit deeper, we'd probably find that there's more of a representation ratio there, that she's represented on about 10% more pages split between four major plots rather than 38 at three. Turning to Thief of Time now, we find that there's a bit of a drop-off, with Susan only appearing on 137 of the novel's 403 pages. So in Thief of Time, she appears on 34% of the PDF pages, which is 10% less than Hogfather and 4% less than Soul Music. And that doesn't sound like a lot, but again, the ratios may tell a different story, because in Thief of Time, she actually appears on 27 more pages than she did in Soul Music, which is over 100 pages shorter, again, according to the PDF lengths. So yeah, even though Soul Music is a shorter book and Susan technically appears more in Thief of Time, she appears on a lower percentage of pages in Thief of Time. We also have a significantly larger gap between Susan's appearances, and these longer gaps also appear far more frequently. We have an early gap of 44 pages between pages 32 and 76 of the PDF, which maybe isn't too much more than the 30-page gaps of the other books, but only about 35 pages later, we actually get an 85-page gap between Susan's appearances, between pages 111 and 196 of the PDF, at which point we only get 4 pages of her still reading Grimm's fairy tales, which is what she was doing on page 111, 85 pages earlier. So we get an 85-page detour through Lobsang and everything with the history monks, and then we come back and we get a 4-page check-in. Susan was still reading the book and thinking about it, and they're just 22 pages later, we get another 49-page gap from page 218 to 267 of the PDF before Susan actually does something else, right? In between when she goes to see Nanny Ogg and then when she shows up later and meets Lobsang when she's rewinding his spinner in Ankh-Morpork. From then on, though, she appears on 89 out of the remaining 141 PDF pages, which is 63%. So almost two-thirds of what's left in the book, Susan's doing things. She's on the page. So while I think her presence, at least, if not her agency, is perhaps understated by a lot of critics when looking at Soul Music and Hogfather, the idea that she just hangs around on the sidelines and then comes in and cleans up things at the end really does seem to apply to Thief of Time. And while I really like Susan's involvement at the end of the book, I did notice, especially on these more recent rereads, but I think on my previous reads as well, that we get a lot of her character at the start where she's being this cool teacher, but then there is there's like a whole section of the middle book where it's really focused on Lob Sang and Lutze, and I guess with bits and pieces about Jeremy and the auditors as well. But I do wish maybe we'd gone back to Susan a bit more in terms of pacing and things. And then when we do go back to her, she's reading Grimm's Fairy Tales, and then she goes and talks to Nanny Ogg, where she doesn't really have to do anything. She just sort of stares her down, and then Nanny tells her things, which I guess you could say about like any kind of detective sort of character, right? They're not actually doing things there. They're finding out things. But in the case of Thief of Time, Susan's not really putting things together or tracking anything down. She's just sort of being told things. So it is a little bit disappointing that now that Susan is fully realized, she is perhaps underutilized. So as Mark Burroughs notes in his Magic of Terry Pratchett biography, what it truly meant to be alive and conscious was clearly preying on Pratchett's mind when he wrote Thief of Time, with Burroughs noting how Lady Ligian becomes aware of her consciousness and individuality in a similar manner to how the amazing Maurice and his educated rodents do in their Discworld novel, which was published just 6 months later. As he points out, characters in both books become aware of what Pratchett calls the darkness behind the eyes, which is a phrase he uses in both Thief of Time and The Amazing Maurice, but nowhere else in the Discworld series or any of his other writings, which brings us to the Doki Doki quote for Thief of Time. Now, if you've been playing along, you'll know that the Doki Doki quote takes its name from the fact that Super Mario Bros. 2 was originally Doki Doki Panic in Japan and refers to an originally interesting citation or piece of trivia that gets repeated so often that it becomes mundane and expected. So this is the quote that is cited in more or less every piece of Thief of Time scholarship, which I am of course only adding to, but in the case of Thief of Time, the Doki Doki quote occurs when Death explains to Susan that spiritual beings like himself are envisioned as human by humans, and thus, in various fashions, they take on some aspects of humanity. It can be no other way, he says. Even our very body shape forces upon our minds a certain way of observing the universe, which is to say he and the other horsemen are bound to pick up human traits because they are human-shaped. So there's quite a lot of physical determinism being implied there, which perhaps lends itself to readings and analysis using evolutionary and literary Darwinism, which I know is something Pratchett is certainly interested in. I mean, he goes into great depth about this stuff in the Science of Discworld books. It was also something Alice was interested in and certainly much more knowledgeable about than myself. It's not something I really want to go into here. I mean, perhaps it might be something I revisit when we get to the Science of Discworld novels. But in terms of how I and many other Pratchett scholars have engaged with this and how I want to engage with it here is coming more from a philosophical and identity theory angle rather than a more scientific one that engages with actual biology and things, which as much as I think Pratchett is interested in, inspired by that angle, the way he's implying it in the Discworld, you know, isn't taking actual biology into account or anything. This is more of a priori philosophical investigation. So that's how I'm going to approach it, at least for now. And while it's perhaps most obvious and foregrounded in Thief of Time, this is a theme that Pratchett revisits over and over again in Discworld. And indeed, in his 2014 book, Fantasy Politics and Postmodernity, Andrew Raymond describes this kind of shape and body determinism as an effect cause inversion of the relationship between identity and being, which Pratchett deploys again and again in order to demonstrate the absurd world implied by a descriptivist view of language. And he points out comparisons to characters like the swaggering wooden-legged bandit chief in Weird Sisters, who has obviously studied his role, and the cook Mrs. Pleasant in Witches Abroad, who Pratchett writes takes great care to bustle and make sure she stays fat and is naturally jolly. Raymond also cites the clock-making cuckoos in Thief of Time as Pratchett's most comic demonstration of the uncanny illogic of a descriptivist language, within which there can be no symbolic without real, and Raymond goes on to claim that signified truly dominates over signifier in Pratchett's fiction. So I think what Raymond's saying there is that because Mrs. Pleasant is fat and jolly, she therefore is naturally inclined to be a cook, and that because the bandit leader swaggers, he naturally falls into the role of being a bandit. Now, there's quite a bit to unpack there. And I think maybe Raymond's got it backwards, because if we just want to nail down some definitions of terms, the signified is the meaning or an idea which is expressed by a sign, while the signifier is the physical form of the sign itself. So by claiming that the signifier dominates the signifier in Pratchett's fiction, Raymond is claiming that the physical form of something determines its meaning, which seems to match up with what Death is saying in Thief of Time to Susan, that he is becoming more human because he is human shape. However, and here we're getting into, you know, confusing complexities, because we've got a fictional world where characters represent things and their essence, if I want to dip into my Sartrean existentialist terms, that their essences are thought out and determined by an author, rather than even within the definitively dualist metaphysical world of the Discworld, you know, things aren't just invented and left to exist according to some kind of natural or even metaphysical rule. There is an author who is moving parts and coming up with the parts for their purposes. Because the other important part of what Death says is that although his physical body does inform the way he behaves, the reason he is human-shaped is because he is envisaged as human by humans. So if we actually trace the cause and effect chain through that statement, it is the signifier, the idea of humanity, that precedes the signifier of Death's physical human form. Moreover, when defining narrativium, which is the narrative force that the Discworld runs on, theoretically, when defining narrativium in the First Science of Discworld book, Ian Cohen and Jack Stewart write that on Roundworld, things happen because the things want to happen, which is to say they happen because things obey the rules of the universe. A rock has no detectable opinion about gravity, but the conversely, what runs Discworld is deeper than mere magic and more powerful than pallid science. It is narrative imperative, the power of story. It is part of the spin of every atom, the drift of every cloud. It is what causes them to be what they are and continue to exist and take part in the ongoing story of the Discworld. So I would say that in Discworld, the signified, the meaning or the idea itself, determines how signifiers being their physical embodiments behave, right? It's not that cooks are fat and jolly because Mrs. Pleasant is. Mrs. Pleasant is fat and jolly because she is a cook. And while Pratchett and is playing with these ideas in Witches Abroad by saying that she was sort of naturally born into this role, she is expressing the idea of being a cook rather than setting the standard of what a cook is. And it's the same with the Bandit Chief, right? It's not that he is a bandit because he swaggers. The implication there is that he swaggers because he is a bandit, and that to not swagger would to not be to truly signify the essence of being a bandit. And if we go back to Hogfather, we have Death saying that he is this amalgamation of all these traditional representations of Death, and the same with the Hogfather, and by analogy, the round world Father Christmas being this analogy of traditional Christmas gods and figures, right? Death is human-shaped rather than being this big, you know, infinite eye creature that Azrael is, because he's been imagined as being human. And the same with the Hogfather is no longer pig-shaped because people have stopped imagining him or associating him as the god of the hunt, but rather as the humanoid spirit of Hogswatch, right? And Hogfather Pratchett is very clear that the Hogfather has no physical form, right? He's not this pig god that is forced to behave like a pig because he is pig-shaped, that his shape changes and is completely determined by the human imagination. And to apply this to, I guess, my overall existential investigation of the Death series, this is to say that in Discworld, essence precedes existence, even outside of the idea that all of this is coming from an author's mind and imagination, that the actual mechanics and metaphysics of Discworld itself are the inverse of the Sartrean secular conception of existence preceding essence that we talked about in relation to Reaper Man. Nevertheless, though, Raymond's stance in relation to Thief of Time is It's understandable, because it is the opposite with the auditors, at least in this book. Right? By taking on physical forms, their behavior starts to be influenced and determined by their forms. And perhaps the auditors are a different case because they are a different order of being to Death and the other imagined gods and figures, in that the auditors seem to be this metaphysical force. They don't rely on the belief and things. They are just a raw manifestation of order. But in that case, even and then they're by embodying order, their behavior is sort of predetermined by the signified idea of order that determines their behavior as signifiers of order, if that makes any sense. As in Reaper Man here, we're running into the conflict of trying to assert a secular humanist philosophy within a framework that is definitively metaphysical, but I don't think that's me or other readers trying to bring a secular humanist reading to something it's incompatible with. Pratchett is very clearly and often stated that he is a secular humanist, and that is the philosophy that he is representing, signifying even in the Discworld series. But when you try and draw a direct one-to-one analogy with the real world, it starts to break down because, of course, it doesn't match. That's the whole point. Unless you make, I guess, perhaps a meta move and realize that just as Roundworld is sitting on a shelf in Rincewind's room in the Unseen University, Discworld 2 is part of the real world. And therefore, from a secular point of view, the books themselves do in fact emerge as a result of natural and physical laws, right? I think I'm maybe delving into territories that I don't have the tools to answer, and delving off the deep end and into territories that I don't have the tools to answer, or, you know, that perhaps can't be answered, right? We're getting into like actual ontological metaphysics here. And then we're also treading dangerously towards the question of like, well, then why do these fantasy archetypes emerge? Which more broadly is what Joseph Campbell tried to do with the monomyth and the hero's journey, or why are these similar story structures seem to be emerging consistently across different cultures, different times, without there being any sort of cross contact, which is what Freudian psychoanalysis was getting at, that there is some kind of unconscious ideas and symbols that are made manifest and signified through human culture and human expression, which is kind of to say that round world works like Discworld, and that the symbolic determines the real, rather than what I and many people who reject psychoanalysis would say, that the symbolic emerges from the real and is a product of culture rather than its determinant, which again, we get back into evolutionary and literary Darwinism and things like that, which I don't want to delve into, but I am trying to try and draw all these threads that I've been planting throughout my analysis of the death sequence about the hero's journey and existentialism and things like that, and try and pull them all together here at the end. And I don't have, you know, some big concluding statement here, but I feel like there is a general thrust that I'm getting at, that Pratchett has been circling around this entire series. So that was ostensibly my analysis of Lady Lejeune and the auditors. I mean, I didn't want to repeat the kind of character and identity analysis that gets applied in all these academic articles I've been reading, where they, you know, just trace out the plot of she's this type of spiritual character who becomes this physical character and rejects the metaphysical determinism of the auditors, and then, you know, utilizes the physical manifestation against them. I mean, we have the scenes at the end. She defeats them using, you know, Star Trek logic kung fu about, you know, ignore the sign that doesn't exist or whatever. But, you know, she's also asking them to do what in Hogfather Death said couldn't be done, the idea that you pick apart a piece of art and try and find its essence within all the atoms, which is again kind of an argument for metaphysical dualism. You know, I did go and pull out my old identity theory readers and things and troll through them for something that might apply here, and I didn't find anything too interesting or applicable that I wanted to pursue. But a famous argument in favor of dualism is called the knowledge argument, which was forwarded by the Australian philosopher Frank Jackson in the 1980s in an attempt to demonstrate that perfect physical knowledge doesn't equate to perfect experiential knowledge. It's called the Mary's Room thought experiment, where you have a girl, her name's Mary, I don't know why, but that's her name, and she's in a room and doesn't have access to the outside world. I think she has a black and white TV that there are programs on it that tell her everything about physics and the physical sciences and everything, so that theoretically, if she has 100% perfect knowledge of physics and the physical world, and the world is 100% physical, as physicalists would assert that it is, that if she has perfect knowledge of physics, then she should therefore be able to extrapolate from that 100% of everything that's in the world, but that she can't understand color, because even if she could write out a mathematical equation, you know, to produce red light by diffracting light or whatever, she wouldn't actually know what red or whatever color actually looks like, calls it the qualia being the actual quality of red. I don't know why they don't just say quality or experience or whatever. And therefore, the argument is that while the idea of red is expressed within the physical equations, the quality, the experience of red and color itself can't be captured, and therefore there is something outside these physical rules, therefore there is something beyond the physical. And I reject this thought experiment, though I can't express specifically why off the top of my head right now, but I suspect there is a flaw in the assumptions being made, or just the limitations of trying to express everything through a black and white TV or mathematical equations or anything, right? Being able to express something is already a compromise of knowledge. We're already taking a step away, but then maybe that reinforces the dualist argument. I don't really want to go further down this path, but that is to say that someone like Pratchett or Sartre even, who would want to assert that the world is physical and that everything can be captured and explained within physical laws, at the same time we have Pratchett appealing to this romantic and definitively metaphysical notion that, well, art isn't contained within the physical laws, that you can't dissect the atom and discover art, that you can't write out the mathematical formula and understand what it's like to see red. It's kind of paradoxical, which, again, I think perhaps stems from trying to assert this physicalist philosophy through a very clearly metaphysical story that is itself a metaphysical or imaginative construction, though at the same time it might equally be due to authors and artists wanting to elevate themselves and what they do above the physical realm, that, you know, perhaps if you had perfect knowledge, there would be a way to write out the perfect formula for a piece of art, that, or even that through perfect observation, you would be able to nail down and define people's response to that art. So that's what's going on with the auditors in general, I think. Of course, the other thing that has to do with identity and self-determinism is this idea of naming, as all the academics spend a long time unpacking and pointing out. Lady Lejeune is Lady Legion, she is many, and then through her physical manifestation is able to assert herself as an individual, at which point she renames herself Unity. And of course, individuality is a theme that has been running throughout the Death series since at least Reaper Man, so I don't want to delve too much more into that, given that we've already discussed it in relation to Reaper Man and Hogfather and things. But what I do find interesting there is, again, we have another set of cause and effect in the naming, right? Is she called Legion or Unity as a reflection, an expression, a signifier of her individuality or multiplicity? Or does the fact that she calls herself Myriad Legion reinforce her idea and put her in that box that she can't escape from? Now, in Lady Lejeune's case, it's pretty clear of the cause and effect there, unless you want to get into the metaphysical thing of did Pratchett name her before he came up with this idea, before she existed? But there's a lot of other stuff going on with the names of the characters in Thief of Time, which, if we're buying into the fiction, Lady Lejeune stands apart from, in that she, ironically, is self-determined. She names herself, whereas a lot of the other characters in Thief of Time are presumably given their names. Some of them are explicitly given names, and these names not only reflect their role in the fiction, but also perhaps have some bearing on their behavior itself. So that is the angle I want to take when looking at the other characters in Thief of Time, who, quite frankly, don't get as much attention. So while Lutze is one of the more memorable characters from Thief of Time, I also think he's one of the more shallow in both the novel and maybe of the more significant characters in Discworld as a whole. In addition to her analysis of Susan, Roberts argues that, as well as a whole bunch of racial stereotypes, Lutze feels at times like a male amalgam of Granny Weatherwax and Nanny Ogg, being capable of great power but mostly happy when people see nothing but a little old unthreatening person and underestimate him. So as with a lot of Pratchett's younger apprentice characters, we're also seeing sort of a repetition of character types in their teachers as well, with Roberts also arguing that Lobsang's frustration with the master, who won't apparently teach him anything while sneakily teaching him all of the important things, mirrors McGrath and Agnes's respective journeys alongside the older Witches of Lankrai as much as it does, you know, Mr. Miyagi's training of Daniel-san in The Karate Kid, which it's a, you know, intended as a direct kind of parody, but Pratchett has been doing this thing before without that reference. There's also a clear parody and lineage to the 1970s American martial arts TV series Kung Fu, wherein David Carradine, who younger listeners and readers such as myself will likely more readily recognize as Bill from Quentin Tarantino's Kill Bill films, which are also a homage and an inversion of Kung Fu, wherein Carradine plays a Shaolin monk, Kwai Chang. He is meant to be, I think, half Chinese in the series. But yes, he plays Kwai Chang, who travels across the American Wild West in search of his half-brother with his apprentice Grasshopper. So we have, you know, obvious echoes of that plot in Thief of Time, even if it is Lob Sang who is seeking his half-brother rather than Lu Tse himself. And we also have a direct reference, or somewhat of an indirect reference, to Kung Fu. When Lu Tse tells Lob Sang, the word one is, you don't call me master and I don't name you after some damn insect, referring to the grasshopper nickname there, which has become just sort of a general cultural phrase and touchstone. It's one that's alluded to on a number of other occasions in Pratchett's work, being also referenced in Good Omens. And I think, interestingly, in his 2002 appraisal of Neil Gaiman as an amazing master conjurer, wherein Pratchett likens himself and Gaiman advising each other about the plots of the books they're writing at the time, in Gaiman's case, American Gods, and in Pratchett's case, The Amazing Maurice, by referring to the other one as Grasshopper, sort of playing up the master and apprentice relationship there, which again, just sort of a common pop cultural phrasing. But I do think it's interesting that if Pratchett's referring to this at the time, that he's writing The Amazing Maurice and Gaiman's writing American Gods, and this was published in 2002, that this is around the time that he has just been working on Thief of Time as well. So perhaps also has that on the mind still. We also have references to grasshopper apprentices in the last two books in Pratchett and Stephen Baxter's collaborative Long Earth series that were published before Pratchett's death, being 2013's The Long War and 2014's The Long Mars. And in looking for these references, because I thought, you know, I'm sure I've noticed Pratchett using this allusion in other works, but searching through them all, it's not as prevalent in his writing as I was expecting, unless, you know, there are other references like the one in Thief of Time that don't actually use the term grasshopper, which is what I was searching for. Though I did discover that just grasshoppers in general strangely seem to be a fairly common simile or just figure in Pratchett's writing. Especially sizzling and frying grasshoppers is often an image he invokes when talking about how hot the weather is. I think there's one in Reaper Man, among other books. So I thought maybe a strange piece of imagery to use, but one that crops up fairly commonly throughout Pratchett's writing, I was surprised to discover. I don't know, maybe it's a common English allusion, I'm not sure. But yeah, in addition to Carradine's Kwai Chang and Mr. Miyagi from The Karate Kid, Lu Tse's position as a sweeper is also appears to be an allusion to Chinese author Jin Yong's novel Demigods and Semi-Devils, which was serialized in Hong Kong and Singaporean newspapers from 1963 to 1966, and I think has become the most famous and influential literary example of the wuxia genre. This is Hong Kong kung fu and martial arts books and films and things. But in this novel, or I guess newspaper serial as it was originally, the most powerful character in all of it is an unnamed Shaolin sweeper monk who only appears in a few scenes. Now, as much as I like a good kung fu movie and quite a few bad ones, I won't pretend an expert, but in any way really knowledgeable at all about wuxia literature or history. I was interested to check out Demigods and Semi-Devils, which does seem like if you're only going to read one wuxia book, then this is the one. It seems like it's kind of the Lord of the Rings of wuxia books. But I didn't read it because it's extremely long. Yeah, it was serialized over, 4 years, and the complete novel consists of 5 books and 50 chapters. Just the first book alone is 201,600 words, which is about 1.5 times as long as Unseen Academicals, which is the longest Discworld novel, clocking in at around 135,000 words. And yeah, it's about twice as long as most of the other longer Discworld novels, which according to Wilkins, never get much above 110,000 words. Also, weirdly, despite its prevalence and cultural significance, there doesn't seem to be an official English translation that's ever been published, as far as I could find. There is an online version at Wuxia Archive, or it's one word, wuxiaarchive.com, which is a collaborative translation just between a bunch of people online. But yeah, it doesn't seem to be available officially in English. So I didn't read Demigods and Semi-Devils. I did read the sections with the monk, though, which take place in chapter 43 of book 5, wherein there's a scene where the five, I guess, sort of apprentices apprentice protagonists are hiding in a library where they are looking for secret kung fu knowledge when they encounter a wizened monk dressed in green robes, holding a broom and sweeping the corridor. The monk is very old, with his sparse long beard completely white, his movements slow and sluggish, lacking in vital energy, so that he does not appear to possess any martial arts. But yeah, it turns out the monk is probably the most powerful character in the whole story. He has a constant chi energy force field around him so that no one can touch him, and is rumored to be able to kill people with a single blow and things like that. It's also revealed that the monk has been leaving books around for the apprentices, who he claims can only achieve true enlightenment by embracing traditional Buddhist routines and rituals. So not too much insight there, other than this being, if not the instigator, then the popularizer of this sort of old secret teacher trope that is specifically a sweeper monk in relation to Thief of Time. There is also a reference in Demigods and Semi-Devils to the monks from Shaolin sending an old monk as their emissary to other temples because they want to be able to deceive people and trick outsiders and stop them from training in their martial arts. So a bit of a leaning towards what is eventually revealed in Thief of Time to be rule one of the, you know, appearing feeble so that your opponents will underestimate you, which again is just a trope through martial arts and wuxia properties, but yeah, it was likely popularized through Demigods and Semi-Devils. So there does seem to be, beyond just a general invocation of kung fu and martial arts culture in Thief of Time, there does seem to be, kind of direct references to Demigods and Semi-Devils, though I do doubt that Pratchett would have actually read it, apart from it just being hugely long, but yeah, not being available in English, and obviously the online translation wouldn't have been available to him when he was writing Time. And while there were a bunch of television adaptations, again, these were produced in Hong Kong and then weren't available in English and probably weren't really available at all in the late 90s, early 2000s. I mean, they're even kind of hard to locate now with all the resources that we have available. But it does seem that Pratchett knew about it somehow, if only by cultural osmosis or perhaps a secondary source that he consulted, or maybe even just through its permeation and likely bastardization in Western series like Kung Fu and The Karate Kid. But there does seem to be some more specific allusions to Demigods and Semi-Devils, which perhaps suggests that Pratchett's engagement with wuxia is deeper or more informed than it perhaps first appears, although I don't think he's really doing any kind of deep reflection or investigation. He is perpetuating the same kind of tropes and parodies that I guess we would expect about Kung Fu films and culture from an English writer in the early 2000s. More interesting, though, and potentially more revealing as well, is that Lutze's role as the sweeper in the Garden of Surprises to me recalls the Master Doorkeeper at the Rogue School of Wizardry in Ursula K. Le Guin's Wizard of Earthsea from 1968. So for people who aren't familiar with that book, the wizard apprentice Ged, or Sparrowhawk as he is known at that point, he goes to this wizarding school where there are 9 wizard masters. Hey, Pratchett, I've suggested before that I think this is perhaps the source of the illusion that Pratchett is making in the early Discworld books about there being 8 masters at the Unseen University, and just the emphasis on 8 in general. There's a lot of emphasis on the number 9 in the early Earthsea novels, whose influence on Pratchett and Discworld I discussed more at length in the Equal Rights episode. But yeah, Sparrowhawk has to find the 9 masters of the Wizarding School, and he can only find 8. And then he eventually realizes that the Master Doorkeeper, the gatekeeper at the entrance of the university, is also one of the wizard masters, and it's suggested that he is perhaps also the most powerful. So playing on those kind of ideas, and that reveal there sort of mirrors that of Lutze. But we also have a connection there between Lutze and the founder of Taoism, Lao Tzu, to whom Lutze's name is obviously an allusion. I have always wondered if there's some kind of parody meant there in Lutze being or meant to read as Lucy, which would perhaps allude to some of the earlier characters like Kelly from Sorcery or Tracy from Pyramids, who have these strange exotic spellings of, you know, sort of standard Western female names. That the audiobook narrators all pronounce his name as Lutze or something similar, but they also pronounce Kelly as Kali and Tracy as Petrachi. So, you know, which I guess is to get across the spelling, but that joke is sort of lost or just not acknowledged in the audio narration. So yeah, I do wonder if Luce is meant to be Lucy. I don't know. I haven't seen anyone else propose that, but it's something I've always thought, and it does seem, as we've been discussing and will continue to discuss throughout this episode, that they're perhaps placing particular emphasis on the names of his characters in Thief of Time. Although Luce first appears, or first appears as a named character, at least Small Gods, over a decade earlier, so yeah, perhaps the name thing wasn't as important then, and it's just a general parody. But again, that would suggest to me that there is more of an inclination for Pratchett to do this kind of girl's name allusion that he was doing in the earlier Discworld novels. But either way, Utsay's name is a reference to Lao Tzu, the founder of Taoism, which strengthens the connection to the Master Doorkeeper in A Wizard of Earthsea, because Le Guin was a Taoist. And a lot of the magic systems and spirituality and ideologies expressed in the Earthsea novels are taken from or inspired by a Taoist philosophy, which Le Guin constantly embedded throughout her other novels as well, including some ideas about time in The Left Hand of Darkness and The Dispossessed that I'll discuss in part two. More significant for this episode and Earthsea in general, though, is Taoism's emphasis on names, right? Earthsea is all about naming magic, and that by knowing the true name of things, you have power over them, but also that people learning their true names, like that's how they learn to understand themselves. A Wizard of Earthsea is essentially about Sparrowhawk discovering that his true name is Ged. We also get repetitions of that sort of journey and discovery in the second and fourth Earthsea books as well. But Le Guin actually produced a translation of the Tao Te Ching, which is the major Taoist text that Lao Tzu wrote. Yeah, she published an English translation of that in 1997, which interestingly is all translated into poetic verse. If you recall in the Soul Music episodes, Eden was talking about how there is a poeticism and lyricism to Le Guin's writing, and here it's on full display, I guess. But I want to read Le Guin's translation of the opening chapter of the Tao Te Ching, which she translates as, "The way you can go isn't the real way. The name you can say isn't the real name. Heaven and earth begin in the unnamed. Name's the mother of the 10,000 things. So the unwanting soul sees what's hidden, and the ever-wanting soul sees only what it wants. Two things, one origin, but different in name, whose identity is a mystery. Mystery of all mysteries, the door to the hidden." So in these final lines about two things, one origin, but different in name, whose identity is a mystery, you know, this is describing yin and yang, which is the central philosophy of Taoism. But we also kind of have an allusion here too, like that's kind of a plot outline of Thief of Time itself, or at least the journey of Long Tseng and Jeremy, which is again, right, this is putting the cart before the horse. Because part of the reason Pratchett is doing that, is creating these characters of Lob Sang and Jeremy, is as an allusion to Taoism and yin and yang, if not directly, explicitly, in general to Eastern and Chinese spirituality. Nevertheless, I do think the Tao Te Ching, and in particular Le Guin's translation, provides an interesting lens to read Thief of Time through, both because of Le Guin's prominent position in the fantasy tradition and her stated influence on Pratchett's writing, but also because, as Wayan Hung and H.B. Dyer point out in their 2017 article on fantasy and Taoism in the Earthsea Cycle, that although the literal translation of a phrase in the first lines of the Tao Te Ching be common name or constant or absolute name, as it is more commonly translated, Le Guin translates it as the real name. I think there's quite a distinction between constant and absolute and real, as much as they might connote parts of each other. There is a value judgment being placed on real as opposed to constant. And I think there's a pretty huge distinction between real and common. They're almost inversions of each other. If you think about them as the common name and the true name, in Earthsea, the common name would be the false name, and the real name would be the true name. So Le Guin herself is placing even more emphasis on this revealing of names and the discovery of the true self and things. In terms of Taoism, as Hoeng and Dai explain, that it is therefore through the naming process and name that human beings start to reach out for the universe and to comprehend the being, which to me sort of shares a common imagery with the rising ape from Hogfather and Pratchett's broader philosophy, and more of a Western and this logocentric emphasis on names and language as both an empowering practice, but also the distinguishing between humans and other supposedly lesser animals. And in indeed, Hoying and Dai relate this idea to the Abrahamic scene in Genesis, where God charges Adam with naming everything, which they claim is so that the internal characteristics of things could find their external manifestations in a direct and unambiguous manner. So in this reading, in a kind of Taoist reading, the names are already there in the other animals, and by naming them, Adam is drawing the true names of things out. Whereas I think a more common Western interpretation of that scene or verse, and certainly one that pervades through vegetarian and critical animal studies, is that this is an imposition. And it says explicitly in Genesis that God grants Adam dominion over the other animals. And the idea there is that Adam is imposing these names onto other creatures as a means of defining them, and then as permeated through culture by controlling them, right? That because he is able to name them, he is able to control them. He is above them. Quite an opposite reading to the Taoist one there. And I think it's interesting to look at how this applies to Thief of Time, because we have a blending of the two. We have this Eastern Taoist spirituality coming through from the history monks that is sort of being asserted as like the true nature of the Discworld in its interactions with time and things, while at the same time explicitly referring to an Abrahamic organization and imagery through the invocation of Apocalypse and, of course, the Four Horsemen. And in general, Pratchett's engagements with religion and the cosmology of the Discworld, despite being based on a Hindu image of the elephants and the world on the back of the turtle, is largely Abrahamic. I mean, obviously, it's a blend, it's a pastiche of all these things. But because Pratchett is an English writer, he is engaging with, first and foremost, I think, Abrahamic and specifically Christian traditions and cosmologies. But as for how the naming thing works, I'm not really sure, because looking at the examples, we have Lutze himself, who his essence, his position as this spiritual guru is implied by his name Lutze being a reference to Lao Tzu, but then his true name that is revealed is that of sweeper, which also following on from the theme of labor in the Death Books is his occupation, right? His identity is defined by his job, but it is something that is imposed on him after the fact. I mean, people's given names are imposed on them after birth. But of course, there's another layer of complexity here that these characters aren't born. They are preconceived in Pratchett's head. And while, you know, it's unknown with most of them whether Pratchett conceived of their names before their characters. In most cases, it seems like he came up with a character and then, you know, he goes, oh, I want to have this spiritual monk character, and then I'll place this name of Lutze on him to cement that illusion. So in that case, the essence is preceding the naming, but in the books, and it seems like what Pratchett himself is saying is that essence is being overwritten by what Lutze himself identifies as, which is his occupation of sweeper, which again is part of this rule one thing of him trying to appear less threatening, and is itself an allusion to the demigods and semi-devils Wuxia tradition. We also have Lobsang and Jeremy, whose characters and naming I'll discuss a bit later, but when they combine at the end of the novel, you know, the combined character takes the name Lobsang as I guess their true name, because he had happier memories as Lobsang, so wanting to preserve that through his naming. So in this case, the essence, although it precedes the combined character, is being maintained and applied by choice as an attempt to embed that essence into the character, into the person themselves. Again, this gets difficult when we're talking about fictional characters and things. As discussed earlier, we also have Lady Lejeune, whose name is an auditor, refers to Legion. So again, the naming coming after the essence, but also as a reflection and a reinforcement of that essence that is then overridden later by her then taking the name Unity to better reflect her individuality. So in all of these examples, we sort of have a contradictory or at least complex interaction of essences preceding naming, but also being derived from names that again is complicated by them being fictional characters whose essences and names are concocted in Pratchett's head, not naturally occurring and developing within a broader cultural context. And I'm not quite sure to the big conclusion, but the two points to take away there, or what seems to be consistently happening, is characters taking their own names, defining their own identity, so that if we go back to the idea of common names and true names, although Le Guin might say they're the same thing, I guess given names and true names, that in each of these cases, a character's true name is the one they give themselves. So it's self-determination, right? Existence precedes essence. But then those true names reflexively defining who they are, both after they've renamed themselves as a reinforcement of their ideologies and aspirations, but also the original common naming being something these characters have to overcome. Lutze less so, because he's kind of leaning into the deception and subterfuge, but Lady Lejeune has to overcome the collectivism and the impositions of the auditors to assert herself as an individual. So she has to break free of the essence implied by her common name to attain the essence implied by her true name of Unity. And then this becomes even further complicated by Lobsang and Jeremy, who in Lobsang's case, as we'll discuss, his name is reflective of his occupation, as is Jeremy's, being Jeremy Clarkson, and less so in Lobsang's instance, but Jeremy kind of has to overcome the dehumanizing clockwork ideal implied by his name to then assert himself as Lobsang and live a happy. In the previous episodes, we've also talked about Susan and her name, and how she has to sort of overcome the blandness of it, as she doesn't change her name, but it's something she grapples with. And I guess there's even some kind of reading to be done there of Death, whose name again relates to his occupation and is defines his existence by that occupation. But his character arc, which he does appear in the later Discworld books, unlike these other characters, but really his character arc finishes here through the death sequence, being a shift from death towards life. Like, ironically, Death is the preserver and champion of life in the Discworld, so there is some implication of this overcoming of naming determination there as well. Now, of course, there is one other character whose naming conventions are explicitly called out in Thief of Time, and which kind of goes counter to these other examples I've given. And that character is, of course, the milkman Ronnie Soak, who, though he tries to assert that as his self-chosen true name, eventually reveals and reverts back to his original name and original occupation as the fifth horseman of the apocalypse, Chaos.
Okay, before I move on to Lobsang, I want to talk quickly about Chaos, Ronnie Soak, as he likes to be called these days. I have a bit more about him and the concept of Chaos in part two, but as with, you know, almost all of the other characters in Thief of Time, Chaos's naming is essential to his character and emphasized by Pratchett as a major part of the big reveal at the end of the narrative. He is, of course, the fifth horseman who left before they got famous. He's the Stuart Sutcliffe of the group, though I think his role is a bit more significant than that allusion or characterization might suggest, because in many Western religions, at least, Chaos is both foundational and oppositional to the good or founding gods, right? We see this in Greek myth, but also in Abrahamic and specifically Christian mythology, which is what Pratchett is primarily playing off with the horsemen and everything. And while, as far as I know, the term Chaos itself is not mentioned or mentioned significantly in the Bible, we do, of course, have Genesis that begins by claiming that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and that the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And here I think we get the allusion or the interpretation of traditional mythological ideas of chaos, which I don't have any concrete examples of because they're hard to pin down, because before this sort of stuff, it's all oral traditions and sort of inconsistent mythologies. There's no canon the way there is in the Abrahamic religions. But while we think of chaos today as this sort of volatile abundance, mythologically and conceptually, it's almost the opposite, in that it is just the opposite of order, which doesn't necessarily imply, I was going to say disorder, but of course it implies disorder, but this volatility. It's more the idea of pre-creation before an order is imposed, which I think is what we get alluded to in Genesis when it says the earth was without form and void. That scene is not chaotic. It's very still. It's very serene. But it is chaotic in that no order or organization has been imposed on what is there. Right? The modern usage of chaos is kind of the opposite of its traditional mythological usage. And then I'll discuss this more in part two, but there's almost a contradictory move both toward and away from chaos in the idea of entropy, right? There's a way of looking at it where everything is chaotic in the beginning, if you want to look at it from a physicalist point of view, with the Big Bang and everything's everywhere and then order gets imposed upon it, but then at the same time that ballistic system is moving towards stillness and entropy, which would be the opposite of chaos, which is what the auditors want, and what chaos as this metaphor for the unpredictability of life and the messiness of life that he's asserting through his humanoid characters, you know, stands in opposition to this ultimate entropy and order that's represented by the auditors. But looking at it from a mythological perspective, from which the character or the mythological concept of chaos derives, what the auditors sort of want is a return to chaos, a return to the formlessness of pre-creation, right? From a religious or mythological perspective, there was nothing that was then shaped into something. So things became more complex rather than less complex, as, you know, the ideas of secular entropy might imply. But that's looking at things through an westernized Abrahamic perspective. But these ideas also exist in Eastern religions and mythology. Again, I'm not an expert in this area, but specifically, they exist in the Tao. So to use Le Guin's translation again, the second verse of the first passage, or I guess the second stanza of the first verse, I'm not good with poetry, but after we get the assertion of the power of naming, we get the second stanza, which reads, "Heaven and the earth begin in the unnamed, that name is the mother of the 10,000 things." And this repeats the form of Genesis, where Genesis says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, right? That is, in the beginning, there was the word and the name, and then that the earth was without form and void until God moved over the surface of its waters. We get heaven and earth begin in the unnamed, and the naming, the God analogy power here, is the mother of the 10,000 things, right? It's following that same narrative pattern. Again, we might want to look at the idea of the monomyth and things. But this is also Le Guin, who comes from a Western and largely Christian Abrahamic culture, imposing her reading upon the Tao. I mean, I don't know how closely this lines up with the original. I mean, other translators give similar versions. I think the Lin Yutang's 2012 version gives it as the nameless is the origin of heaven and earth, and the named is the mother of all things. So Le Guin's prettying things up for the sake of her poetry, but the message does seem to be consistent there, or a consistent interpretation when translating it into English from a westernized perspective, at least. But it's interesting there that we have chaos, the formlessness associated in the Tao, with the unnamed, and that things become more organized once they are named, whereas in Thief of Time, we have Chaos learning his name, becoming Chaos, or re-becoming Chaos once his name is revealed. It's weird to have Chaos, which is namelessness, being named, which again, Pratchett's coming at this from the Christian perspective in his characterization of Chaos, but at the same time is drawing on ideas and putting Chaos in conflict with ideas of Taoism and things. So there's something going on there. I don't know if you can boil it down to anything, but the fact that the Fifth Horseman turns out to be Chaos in a book that is about returning to formlessness, I don't think is incidental. Later in Le Guin's translation of the Tao, we also get verse or chapter or passage or whatever you want to call it, 25, which reads, "Imagining mystery, there is something that contains everything. Before heaven and earth, it is. Oh, it is still, unbodied, all on its own, unchanging, all-pervading, ever-moving. So it can act as the mother of all things, not knowing its real name. We only call it the way." Which is to kind of equate chaos with this naming power. And Le Guin makes this interpretation explicit in her translation, because there is a footnote to this verse where she says, "I'd like to call the something of the first line, that there is something that contains everything before heaven and earth," that she says she'd like to call that something a lump, an unshaped, undifferentiated lump, chaos, before the word, before form, before change. And so she's explicitly identifying this lump as chaos. And then she says, "Inside this lump of chaos is time, space, everything. It is the womb of the way." So although chaos and formlessness are oppositional to order and naming, perhaps the difference between the westernized Christianity and this more Eastern philosophy of Taoism is that in the Christian reading and in Pratchett's characterization of the auditors and everything, that chaos is the opposite of life and order, whereas in at least Le Guin's interpretation of the Tao, chaos contains life, that formlessness contains the power of creation and the potential of life and things. It is the womb of the way. And I think that's interesting to apply to Thief of Time, in that Chaos tries to assert and overcome himself by taking a new name, right? He tries to distance himself from his past by asserting a new identity, but he is ultimately unable to overcome his past, or chooses to reconnect with his past. That Roddy Sorok, as much as he wants it to be, is not his true name, in the sense of Lobsang and these other characters being able to assert their own identities. Chaos seems seems beholden to the nature of his naming, which is a very Taoist idea, I guess. So I think there's something there. Like, I don't think I've quite nailed it down, but there is definitely a reading to be done. I think Pratchett is being very deliberate about the interplay of naming and chaos and the auditors and order and all these things in Thief of Time. Though he would claim it was all a big happy accident, because in The Art of Discworld, he asserts that he found out Ronnie Soak's true name only a minute or two before the other characters, and that he remembers running into the bathroom with the word Soak written on a piece of paper and holding it up to the mirror to check that it was indeed chaos. And this is an often repeated story of Pratchett's. He does relate it in the open book interview on the BBC program, after which Gregory pointedly comments that the idea that Pratchett didn't know that Ronnie was named Chaos seems remarkable. And I think I have to agree. I think it's a pretty remarkable coincidence, if that were the case. Pratchett gives some kind of explanation. He says, well, I've been doing this for a while, and, you know, maybe it was an unconscious, subconscious thing that, yes, it was deliberate on his part and that his brain was putting it together, but the point that he became conscious of it was as he was relating it out. I sort of get what he's getting at there, but he's definitely playing it up. And also, his story about running into the bathroom seems to contradict other historical record of this moment, which comes from Wilkins in the Life with Footnotes biography, wherein Wilkins says that to Wilkins, the reveal of Ronnie's true identity was an utter revelation, that he must have typed the word Soak 200 times by that point without seeing it coming. And he says that, frankly, he didn't think that Terry had seen it coming until it occurred to him at that very moment either. So he's backing up Pratchett there. However, rather than running into the bathroom to check in a mirror, Wilkins says that while Wilkins was out of his chair punching the air and shouting yes, Terry merely sat with his arms folded across his body, his chin down, nodding slowly in a very pleased with himself but determined not to show it kind of way, which does rather contradict the running into the bathroom in excitement story that Pratchett had been spreading for many years. And this, of course, comes after a passage in the biography where Wilkins says that Pratchett was prone to play up stories from his life for comedic effect, and that his historical records weren't necessarily to be trusted. So I'm inclined to go with Wilkins on this one, which does still give Pratchett some credit of perhaps putting this together subconsciously, but also coming across as more of a self-assured Zen master than this self-deceiving unconscious genius. Like, he's almost doing a memento in this one. I think it's a bit far-fetched. And before I move on, there was something else from the open book interview about the chaos naming, which is that when discussing this revelation, Gregory also wryly points out how Pratchett explains twice about chaos's naming. First implicitly, and then a second version, right? It's first implied what his name is, and then there is a second explanation a few pages later, which he says is to make sure everybody was up to date, to which Pratchett responds with a stern hmm. And yeah, I found Gregory to be quite combative in this interview, and I think this is essentially her calling Pratchett out for his writing being perhaps less nuanced than it could be, that he's both explaining twice but also undermining the implication and spelling it out for the reader. And while I think that's perfectly fine for, you know, the Pratchett's readership and the level that his books are pitched at, that at the same time is to concede that, well, maybe it's not Booker Prize worthy if there is this different expectation. But it's also something that I noted when going through it again for the last time, is that at the start, one of the things I was struck by was how implicit a lot of the writing is throughout some of the early parts of Thief of Time. It did seem to me that the writing was a bit more, don't want to say mature, but more nuanced, more subtle than it had been in Pratchett's earlier and, I guess, lesser Discworld novels. I mean, I talked about, I still think Lords and Ladies is the best written of Pratchett's novels, but that is perhaps more to do with its kineticism and the momentum in terms of just subtlety and implication and stuff. I really was struck in the early sections of Thief of Time just how different the tone and the nuance of the writing is through the early passages of the novel. But then I did notice, because I was paying attention to it, that as the book goes on, that seems to drop away. And there were a lot of moments where it did seem like Pratchett was doubly explaining everything, in case you missed it. I can't remember, I should have written it down, but there was something to do with Nanny Ogg's hat. I can't remember the line, but there was something where there was a line about Nanny Ogg, and I was like, ah, that is a very subtle line that is telling you that if you're paying attention, hey, this is what's going on. And then the next sentence was, oh, and she wore a hat because she was a witch, or something like that. It spelled out what was implied, not just previously. Like, I think there is something to you subtly hint at Ronnie Soak's name, and then, you know, you give it a bit and a couple of pages later you do explain it so that if people missed it, they can still follow along with the story. I think that's sort of fine. But there were moments where it was like sentences apart. If something would be implied, and I'd go, oh, that's really crafty and well done. And then it was just immediately explained. And while I don't think that damages the book overall, I do think it stops maybe some of that subtlety and nuance from being recognized, and that maybe the book could have been even better if Pratchett had fully led into that.
So continuing our onomastic investigation now, I want to turn to Lobsang, Lobsang Ludd, whose name seems to have the most significance for his character, although I'm not sure there's any actual meaning there. And there's significance, at least in an allusion embedded in both parts of his name. So I'll start by looking at Lobsang, which is the pretty clear cut one. So Lobsang refers to the British author Cyril Henry Hoskin, who wrote the popular 1956 spirituality book The Third Eye, which claimed to be written by a Tibetan monk named Lobsang Rampa, who Hoskin later claimed had possessed him after the book was revealed as a hoax. So yeah, this is a spirituality book marketed as being written by a Tibetan monk, which actually turns out to be made up and authored by an Englishman. So, you know, we've just got a general allusion to spiritual hoaxes and things. I mean, maybe there's something to be read in there that Lobsang is, you know, someone from Ankh Morpork who is now part of the History Monks, that I guess if the History Monks are coded as Asian, he is coded as English, but he's also the spiritual embodiment of time, so I don't know. And I don't know if there's necessarily anything really going on there about cultural identity and things. I think this is just, you know, a joke, because this is a pretty common allusion for Pratchett, just in reference to Eastern spirituality and things. Firstly, we have the abbot Lobsang in Mort, who's one of the history monks that Mort goes and visits. I think that's where we have the reincarnation scene. And then we also have the passage in Witches Abroad about Magrat learning the way of the scorpion from a book by Grandmaster Lobsang Dibla, which also, interestingly, contains a footnote about the way of Mrs. Cosmopolite. So, again, Pratchett never throws an idea away, much like Hogfather was built out of extrapolation of a footnote in Soul Music. In some ways, there are ideas in Thief of Time that have been built upon the footnote in Witches Abroad, though not to the same extent or as directly descended. But Dibla is again referred to as Lobsang in Guards. So in early Pratchett, it's not just alluding to Eastern spiritualism with the abbot in Mort, but more consistently to fraud with being part of Dibla's identity. However, the identity and allusion is dropped after Guards, after which point Dibla's just CMOT Dibla, and then Lobsang as a name doesn't appear again until Thief of Time. So an allusion with a long history within Discworld, but a fairly just surface level allusion to ideas of spirituality and fraudulism within British culture. The Ludd part of Lobsang Ludd is more complex. Even if it were just a base allusion, the story itself is a bit of a workaround. So, as the annotated Pratchett file explains, Lobby Ludd, Ludd spelt with one D rather than two as Pratchett spells it, was a character created in August 1927 by the now-defunct British newspaper The Westminster Gazette, as part of their summer competition, where they would describe a holiday location, like a beachfront or something, and give a description of a person who'd been seen there who they referred to as Lobby Ludd. So he's sort of this made-up mystery man character. An employee of the newspaper would then dress up to match the description and go to the place and pose as Lobby Ludd at the described location. And if readers approached the person holding a copy of the newspaper and asked them if they were in fact Lobby Ludd, they would win £5, which seems rather elaborate. And I'm just trying to piece this together from some pretty obtuse descriptions of this newspaper competition. But right, that seems to be the surface level allusion, where you've got Lobsang, Lobby Ludd. There you go. Much like with Lobsang just being a reference to a fraudulent writer of books when he's applying it to Dibla, or a knowing reference to fraudulent mysticism and a bit of a cheeky joke about British obsessions with Eastern cultures and things when it's applied to the history monks. works. Lobby Ludd just seems to be like idea and word association. However, I do find it interesting that Lobby Ludd, the newspaper character, is spelt with one D, but Lobsang Ludd is spelt with two Ds, which you might say, well, you know, he's just changing it up so it's a bit more hidden, but Lobsang isn't spelt any different. So why would he feel the need to add an extra D to Ludd? I don't know, right? Again, maybe Pratchett just felt like, but there's a lot of emphasis placed upon the name Ludd within Thief of Time itself, right? The reason that Lobsang Ludd is called Lobsang Ludd is because he was adopted by the Thieves Guild. And in Thief of Time, Pratchett explains that thieves get called Ludd's lads and lasses after one of the founders of the guild. We never get an identity of that Thieves Guild founder or a first name. We just know that one of the Thieves Guild founders, their last name was Ludd, and that they passed that down to their apprentices and disciples and things. And as confirmation of this, we do get the appearance of a young thief named Vinny No Ears Ludd 4 years later in the 2005 Discord novel Thud. Now again, this is perhaps just stemming from the original illusion, right? Working backwards, or I guess going back to the start and working forwards. We've got the Lobsang illusion. We then make another pun out of that by bolting Ludd on the end of it. Lobsang Ludd is a thief, and therefore we want to make something about the name, even though I don't know why we needed that. But we also get told in Thief of Time that orphans adopted by the Ankh-Morpork guilds often have telltale surnames like Ludd or Doey or Pun or Clockson. And the other three are pretty obvious. Doey refers to the Baker's Guild, Pun to the Fool's Guild, and Clockson to the Clockmaker's Guild. And of course, we get confirmation of the significance of Clockson through the character of Jeremy Clockson, which again, we have a sort of double pun where there's the Clockson allusion to the Clockmaker's Guild, which he has inherited by being adopted as well. And then Pratchett's done the thing I was suggesting with Lobby Ludd, where he starts with Clockson. Clockson sounds like Clarkson. Jeremy Clarkson is a person, therefore we're going to have a pun of Jeremy Clockson. A rather unfortunate pun, perhaps, given how much of complete bellend Jeremy Clarkson is, but I do think that is where it begins and ends. This is pure word and sound association, right? Maybe there's some kind of illusion you could argue with, like, Jeremy Clarkson being associated with engineering, but it's not like he's a race car driver. This is just bolting Jeremy on the front of Clarkson to make a sound-alike association. The reason why I don't want to go any further with Jeremy Clarkson, but I do think there's something more to Lobsang Ludd, though, is that we don't then get told repeatedly, twice, that the first name Jeremy carries with it significance about the person's identity and guild allegiances. So I guess what I want to know is, what is so telltale, and that's Pratchett's word, that they have telltale surnames? What is so telltale about Ludd that relates it to the Thieves Guild? Right, this idea of tracking down Lobby Ludd in the newspaper competition, but as far as I can find, the Westminster Gazette's Lobby Ludd was always described as a mystery man rather than a thief, right? He's not Carmen Sandiego, right? As far as I know. Again, I have no idea, this is some 1920s newspaper competition, but that there doesn't seem to be anything there, even though that is the obvious reference. In Brewer's Book of Names, there is no entry for Ludd, although it does have one for the Luddites, who it notes were textile workers, not thieves, so maybe Ludd would be a more appropriate and layered name for the Seamstress Guild, perhaps. But yeah, Brewer's Book of Names also proposes that the Luddites were named after the 18th century livestock worker Ned Ludd, who earlier destroyed automated stocking machines. But again, nothing about thievery, so it would perhaps make sense for the Butcher's Guild, if there is one, to be named Ludd. The Farmer's Guild, but nothing pointing towards thieves here. And there is some kind of thematic allusion there, perhaps. I think people would be bringing this to the book rather than Pratchett embedding it in there himself, but right, Butler calls it out. He says that by calling the new novice Ludd, the Luddites who fought against the introduction of machines in the early industrial age are invoked. That is a weird sentence if we want to rewrite that in the active voice. Pratchett invokes the Luddite fought against the introduction of machines in the early industrial age by calling his new novice Ludd. So there's perhaps a connection there, and if there's not one intended by Pratchett, we have one being proposed by the foremost academic scholar of Pratchett's work, but this still doesn't explain the thieves' connection or the significance there. If we turn to Google, it brings up a website called House of Names, which claims the Anglo-Saxon name Ludd, with two D's this time, derives from the Old English word lad, meaning someone who worked as a servant or a patron. cage for a night. There's an allusion there to Lobsang's character in that he is sort of the perpetual apprentice. So he is the lad serving both in the Thieves Guild, where he is one of Lud's lads, and also as the apprentice to Lutze in the History Monks. And all of that lines up, except for the part where we're told that Lud is a telltale name of association with the Thieves Guild. So I am rather anticlimactically going to end this section by saying I've got nothing. I've looked into this and there's lots of leads and things, but I can't find, not even a satisfactory, I can't find any connection between the name Lud and thievery. Right? Maybe it's just a pun that we got from Lobby Lud, Lobsang Lud, the same way we did with Jeremy Clarkson and the Clockmakers Guild, but there's such emphasis placed on it on multiple occasions in Thief of Time, plus it gets repeated and reinforced in Thud, so there definitely seems to be some significance there. Moving away from names, you know, just trying to find a general definition for Lud, you know, I looked it up in the OED, the Oxford English Dictionary. No entry for Lud with two Ds. We've got two entries for Lud with one D. One is an archaic exclamation of surprise. The other as another name for the Utox, which seems like something Pratchett might have liked to pun on, but I don't think he was intending to in this case, and if he was, doesn't really carry any significance with it. Just looking it up on Google and trying other dictionaries and things, you just get a whole bunch of references to the Luddites, which, like, there are themes of technological progress in Thief of Time, but not really in relation to Lobsang. I mean, maybe you could do a reading, and we'll look at this more in part two, but a reading where Jeremy, as the clockmaker, represents new technology and trying to harness and fit everything into these modern scientific ideas, and, like, Lobsang being the one who's opposing him, who's trying to stop him. I mean, his literal mission throughout Thief of Time is to break a machine, to break the clock. And, you know, you could go off about how, well, eventually they combine at the end of the book so that, you know, it's about balance rather than industry versus traditional methods and ideas and things, which I think that is quite a rich reading you could have by going that path. But again, that doesn't have any significance or connection to the Thieves Guild, which we are told repeatedly Lud directly invokes. So I don't know. And in a last desperate attempt to find anything here, I did indeed turn to the Urban Dictionary, which has a bunch of proposed slang definitions that I don't think anyone's actually ever used. There is one for Lud with two Ds, which claims is a derogatory term for a union member. I don't think that has any significance or relevant. And then there are a bunch of different proposed definitions for Lud with two Ds and an E at the end, so L-U-D-D-E, none of which are useful, but I did find it interesting that there was one, and if I'm going to give it a proper academic citation, this was submitted by a user named Red Forence on August 12, 2020, who claims Lud is commonly used in text messages, but has no meaning whatsoever. If you see a person randomly replying with Lud, they are trying to be edgy or waste your time trying to Google this word. So perhaps, you know, I feel like that's what Pratchett may have done to me as well. I mean, I've spent multiple days trying to look into this and then digging into the Luddites and traditional English name meanings and things. So yes, perhaps indeed Pratchett was simply trying to be edgy and derail ambitious scholars who take his work too seriously. I don't think that's true. Yeah, I don't think he would have pointed out on multiple occasions in their book the significance of Lud if that were the case. But the kind of frustrating part of it is when he points it out, it's as if it's self-evident, as if it is as intuitive as Dewey for a baker. Yeah, and of course, if you Google Lud thieves or theft or anything, you just get references to Pratchett the Thief of Time. So yeah, I don't know. I'm stumped by this one. If anyone knows, let me know, right? Send me an email at unseenacademicalspod@gmail.com.
So that is it for this first episode. A bit of an inconclusive one, but just the fact that it exists at this point is somewhat of a minor miracle. Listening back to that last Lobsang section as I was editing it, I did realize that, you know, perhaps there's another parallel to be drawn with the old archaic definition of Lud as an exclamation of surprise, which would then tie into, you know, Lutze's garden and the five elements and things like that. But again, that's linking it more to the History Monks, which is the Lobsang side of his name and doesn't give us any connection to the thieves at all. So I am still stumped. But yeah, hopefully you got some kind of enjoyment or insight out of my ramblings there, and I will be back when I can with part two, looking at the nature of time and some literary connections with the novel as well. But yeah, I'll carry on more then. Bye.
And we're clear.